It is Saturday, October 27th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the week in geek news, and the second half, your questions and comments of technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we're going to be taking a look at the geek news of the week. In the second half, we'll invite you to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. You can contact us right now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics. Offer an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Ben Jaffe, Ryder Brooks, Alex Lias, and Miles Elam. Geeks, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning.
Let's put all these mics on. Let's try it again. Miles?
Good morning.
Alex?
Good morning.
Ryder?
Good morning.
And Ben?
Morning.
All right, so Ben, it's your first time in the air room. Welcome to the Geek Speak.
Thanks.
Ben works with me at UCSC. He's a student in, student in theater focus?
Yeah.
So thespian. And he's also a geek and has Leopard running on his Mac, so I thought we could talk a little bit about Leopard today since that's a big release from last night by Apple, the new operating system. Ryder, you work for Sun Microsystems as a support engineer.
Sure do.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And Alex, you're still an application security analyst for Fidelity Mutual?
Yep. Actually, Fidelity National Financial.
Sorry about that.
Whole different company.
Different company, really? Just the same first part?
Yeah.
Alphabetically the same, but other than that, totally different. And Miles Elam's a slacker. Hi.
Fair enough.
Still a student, too.
Yep.
All right.
Now a tutor.
Haven't dropped out yet. Tutor. That's right. You have a job. All right.
That's unslackerish of you.
Making sure other people don't slack.
No, teaching others how to slack.
Oh. All right.
Effectively.
Good. Effectively slack. First news story, we'll go to Miles.
In the past, I have gushed over the One Laptop Per Child project. This is the project to bring a low-cost laptop to every child in the developing world. They've done something new, something that I wasn't quite expecting. They're experimenting with cow-powered laptops. The story from Computer World is describing a plan to drive a dynamo from an old Fiat through a system of belts and pulleys using cows or cattle. And this is in areas that may not have a consistent amount of sunlight, so you couldn't charge it that way, and not enough consistent wind, not enough water nearby, or consistent water sources nearby to be able to run water generator? Anyway,
generator?
Yeah, for some reason my mind blanked out.
That's right.
And the cost of gas is way too high. So what do they do? Well, rural India, you do have cattle, and they are used for other things like, you know, grinding.
So this is this is like a pivot point generator. So you've got an axle going out and cattle around the outside that rotate.
And so they just, you know, you're walking them around, and usually this is used to grind or mill grains, but it could just as well be used to generate electricity.
Cool. And is this in place anywhere, or are they just talking about it?
No, they're prototyping it. Uh-huh. So they're going to try this out, see if it works, and then see how feasible it would be to actually build up items like this.
Doesn't this make the laptop less portable? Or can you just take the cows with you?
So no, the laptop still has a battery. You can still take it. This is if when you're going to charge it up, right. You know, where do you take it to? And this is one of those areas. Like right. Central place in the village, you plug it in and...
Thank interesting. You, I mean, you think about the cows going around in circles. You'd have to have some gearing in order to get the real speed or energy necessary. Mm-hmm. So, but it's old technology meets new.
That's true. All right, next news story, Alex.
Sure. It seems that the U.S. Senate has actually gone and passed the bill that will extend the 1998 Internet Tax Freedom Act. So basically, the internet will be tax free for 4 to 7 more years. So.
I heard a little bit about this, and this is the idea that service providers can't give you a tax on it above and beyond what like the phone costs are, and therefore cable companies, there's no tax involved. Is that kind of what we're talking about? We're not talking about sales online.
No, we're talking about federal tax, usage tax of the internet.
Just like you have on your phone lines. So you can they tax, you know, there's actually a federal tax that goes on your phone and...
I've actually heard varying things about this, one being that, but also the idea of an internet sales tax. If you buy something over the internet, that it would have some sort of tax associated with it. So that would, at least that's what the tax was originally, saying that no, the federal government is not allowed to do this.
All right. Well, we don't know the full deal. You guys are a little conflicting on this.
Sure.
It may cover both items. Yeah. But then again, the federal government, the FCC, does charge a tax for phone lines already. So that's already in place. That's why I tend to think it has to do more with the internet sales tax.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. Ryder?
So Google came out this week and added IMAP support for their free mail provider. You know.
For Gmail.
For Gmail.
Yeah. Yeah. Does anyone have an account that has IMAP running?
I do, yeah.
Do you like it?
Yeah, it's pretty nice. I mean, it's, you know, IMAP's a little slower initially if you have a large collection and it looks like by default it tries pulling off all the headers of all your mail. So if you've been using it for a while, it could take a while for the initial load. But it's really nice. I mean, I've been kind of an IMAP convert for years now, and I've always kind of bemoaned that Gmail offered a free service, but it wasn't IMAP.
Now, IMAP, the standards of IMAP talk about folders and not tags, but Gmail uses tags for classification. So how does that work?
You know, I haven't really delved into that deeply. I know that, you know, I use Thunderbird, supports tags. It doesn't look like the same tagging mechanism. Yeah.
Is there automatically a folder that's like archive folder that has all
It has all your folders that you have. It's basically there's a parent Gmail folder. You expand that, and it has all of your folders that you would see on your website if you logged in through the web. Huh. Plus, it has your standard inbox that you would have on your mail.
I guess I'm not making folders in Gmail.
Yeah. From what I understand in Gmail, the tags display as folders. That your email would show up.
You know, I don't deliberately tag in Gmail.
That's what I've been hearing on reports online. Unfortunately, Google has not seen fit to set up my account to have IMAP. So,
what have you checked today?
Yes, I have checked today.
Okay.
I would really love to use it for my iPhone.
But it's really nice. I mean, I don't know of any other free mail service provider that, yet alone, has POP access. You know, and IMAP. So it's a really nice feature.
One thing I got to say, though, they actually do IMAP over SSL. I was reading through their instructions, and they always specify SSL.
SSL
which is,
or TLS.
Yeah, it's really nice because, I mean, you have so many places that provide their free email even over POP, and it's just passwords, clear text, and, you know, there goes your email.
You know, and another cool feature is that with IMAP, you can, through your mail client, you can drag mail from other IMAP providers or your local mail into your IMAP folder, and so you can effectively upload mail from other providers into Gmail as an archive. So you can take advantage of the 4+ gigabytes of storage that they provide now.
Yeah, very nice. All right, so Gmail, IMAP, Ryder's the only lucky one of the geeks, I guess.
No, nope, Sean's got it.
Sean's got it?
But he's not here to talk.
Man! Ben Jaffe, hi.
Hi.
Got news for us? News story for us?
Yeah, Leopard came out yesterday.
I heard something about that. New operating system by, what's the company?
Apple.
Yeah.
And I actually just installed it yesterday, and it's pretty cool. It's got a couple, it's got a lot of new features, and a few of them are really, really neat. If you like iTunes, the new iTunes, it's got the different sidebar and cover flow and everything, and now the Finder has it all too. So.
Yeah, cover flow in the Finder is kind of interesting. This is viewing your images and any of your files on your computer is large form previews. And there's a lot of preview enabled inside the Finder, so you don't have to actually launch an application to get an idea of what the file is. Assuming that Apple made or Apple has access to the interface or the protocol.
Yes, and also just being able to scrub through them really quickly and being able to see like if you're going through photos, for example, you can very quickly identify which photo you want to see just by watching them flow past.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, so I noticed that you don't have this installed on your laptop directly. You have it on an external drive, which is very external. It's just a hard drive sitting on a magazine in the air room here. Yeah. Luckily, not vibrating anymore to interfere with the radio. But
does that mean why you haven't fully committed?
Yeah,
that's exactly. I don't know. I install a lot of freeware and shareware third party applications just to make things faster for me personally and customize it more than Apple lets you, and some of those don't work with Leopard yet, because some of the developers went and took the plunge and got in the developer community and everything, but a couple of these people are just developing one side application on the side, and so they don't have the money to go and delve in and everything. So literally the developers who are creating the applications that I'm running, a lot of them just got their hands on Leopard the same time I did yesterday. Right. And so,
some of these third-party apps, and you want your computer to use them. Yeah,
yeah. One of them, Mail Acton, it's an add-on for Mail, and it's really useful. And I emailed the author yesterday and said, "Hey, when is a Leopard version coming out?" He said, "I just got it, so early next week, maybe."
I use Acton too. I don't use it for sorting like you use it for. I use it for throwing mail into archive folders.
Yeah,
very convenient. Yeah. One keystroke allows you to move mail files around.
Yeah, they didn't actually seed out a developer release for developers until the day that they released the Gold Master to the public. Presumably because they didn't want it to leak out, which it did anyway, actually. I definitely saw BitTorrents out on the internet with the final build, days before it was publicly available. But there's been a lot of developers that are in that situation where they're like, we want to wait until we have the final cut so we can make sure that it works properly. So you got to wait.
And so that's why I installed it on a hard drive that's an external hard drive, so I can just run my normal laptop with Tiger on it whenever I go to work, when I'm doing my thing. But then I can also play with Leopard and maybe see what is new about it, see if I like it, customize it, mm-hmm. and then once those applications that I rely on so heavily get updated to work with Leopard, then I can just copy my external hard drive onto my internal hard drive, and I'll have it already in there.
I'm sure a lot of these developers that are just got a hold of it are going to be working very hard to do this. But I did see an announcement yesterday that FileMaker, which is an Apple company, is not compatible. The most recent version of FileMaker is not compatible with Leopard. And if that's the company's owned by Apple, it seems kind of shocking. I'm sure it'll be quickly released. But right now, the recommendation, if you use FileMaker 9. I always lose track. Maybe it's 8. The newest version is 9. That's right. If you're using that, don't switch over to Leopard yet because it'll have problems. Mm-hmm. So hopefully the developers will be better than the FileMaker staff in getting their apps done, or maybe it won't be as complicated.
Most of them have been, actually. I'm really surprised when I booted into Leopard for the first time after importing all of my stuff over. Most of the stuff just worked exactly like it did in Tiger. And that was really nice to see.
Are there any sites out there that identify applications that don't work? Because I think that's something a lot of people would really be interested in. I mean, I know my girlfriend's father, I was talking to him about whether certain applications would work. And, hopefully most things will, but it'd be nice to know if there was a list out there. So
if there is a list, I don't know of it, but if there is a list, it's growing rapidly because, of course, people are trying new apps that no one's tried before. There's, thousands and thousands of applications on Apple. The question I got for all of us in the air room is, we're all using Macs as kind of our primary machines for email and, for stable use. Of course, Sean reminds us that when we really want to do serious computing, we use our Windows machines. But in any case,
serious computing meaning
gaming.
Yeah.
And art creation. I use Windows machines all the time for art creation. But or helping other people make art. I don't actually make art. the Macs that we use, we really rely on them. So now, Ben has taken the time to install it on an external hard drive. Any of you feel like grabbing Leopard really soon and making it your primary OS?
How long
did
you
wait? Oh, you already did?
Yeah, yesterday.
Are you running Leopard right now?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't hear that before.
You didn't have time.
It's like
I got all sorts of comments on it. I can tell you about all sorts of quirky behavior with CoverFlow. Mm-hmm. I'll wait to my next turn.
Yeah, let's not have Ryder talk
cool, at all. Though.
Ryder, go in the back. No. Well, I'll take your turn right now. What do you like about CoverFlow?
Well, do you like about I found a very humorous little thing about CoverFlow. When you go and look at the network, shared network, there is an icon for both Linux and PCs that shows up as a monitor with a blue screen of death.
Huh. No way.
It does.
Yeah.
And, I'm assuming it doesn't work CoverFlow on their shares then.
You mean
the CoverFlow icon?
The
is
icon
the blue screen
for
of death.
For that PC.
That's pretty funny.
And it shows, you know, a nice, you know, cinema display for Macs. But it's in there. I don't know if that was a joke that they meant to pull out, but in there.
Bet that wasn't authorized by Steve Jobs.
Get it. Make sure to get a screen grab.
Oh yeah, I got a URL right here.
Well, also, get a good copy of it.
That's and another thing that I had problems with is I have a lot of. You know, on some of my Linux boxes, I have most of my video archive and I have a lot of DivX and Xvid formatted PCs. Those, if you put in the extensions into QuickTime to support those, they will play locally just fine. But I've found that the QuickView on CoverFlow will not play them, even though it will do the thumbnail for it within CoverFlow as you scroll and you can see the initial frame snapshot of it. It won't seem to do the QuickView play.
Did you restart your Mac after installing DivX?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that you'd
got
want
some bugs to work out.
Yeah. Well, you'd want the CoverFlow app to be very. Very good at what it does, not bloated in any way, because it's going to be doing this so much. So the conversion rate's going to be so much. So
they're supposed to say that you know, anything that will run within QuickTime, it should run over CoverFlow, which it doesn't seem to be the case.
All right,
but
are you using CoverFlow as the main way of navigating your computer?
No, it's a gimmick for me. I mean, I don't have an iPod that I use with my iMac. So that, you know, with iTunes, you know, when I used to be on the PC, I never used iTunes because I didn't like the port for Windows. It just seemed buggy So I haven't, you know, it's kind of cool. It's definitely helpful for viewing photos.
Yeah.
The PDF stuff doesn't mean that much to me. Certain text attachments, it doesn't seem like, you know, I have a lot of NFO files that, you know, and TXT. It's certain extensions, even if you have it associated with the right viewer, it still doesn't seem to quick view it.
So. Yeah. I don't use iPhoto. I'm a Mac user to a large degree, but I don't use iPhoto to manage my photos. So I'm kind of looking forward to being able to step through without launching an application, step through something that's native to the Mac and look at files.
It's relatively fast. I mean, it basically does partial loads of thumbnails. So as you sit there longer looking at it, it starts, you know, the clarity starts increasing. So if you're just scanning through real quick, you know, you just
well,
give
let's,
it an idea.
Let's, since we're doing kind of a leopard show to some degree, we'll do some more news. But I want to ask about, I saw the demo about Time Machine, the backup, the automatic backup solution. Anybody else have any comments about that?
Well, I tried to install it, but it requires a disk that's at least the same size as the disk that you're backing up.
Interesting.
So unless you selectively tell it what to back up, but
and you can do that.
Yeah, and they recommend actually a 2-to-1 ratio.
Right.
So
because as files change, it keeps a copy.
It seems kind of cool, but you know, for me. I have other backup methods. So,
what do you use for your backup method?
I basically just use my Linux machine and I use an rsync.
You do use rsync?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's doing the same thing, it's just that the server, the responsibility is not in your base OS, it's on an application.
I believe Time Machine, after it does a base backup, it does a differential backup.
It does do differential.
Yeah. So it's a little different than rsync. But
rsync doesn't do differential?
Well, it does a checksum between files, and it basically keeps a synced copy, but all it transfers is the differences. So rather than backing up just the differences, it's transferring it over
maintains the copy. In rsync, if you've modified a file and then you... rsync again. Do you destroy that copy of the original file before it was modified, or do you have a second copy of it?
It's optional. I think you can do it either way.
Which way you do it?
I'm basically just destroying.
Yeah,
the original.
You are. So you better.
I mean,
save a file without.
You know, I'm not doing any. Actually, I don't even know if rsync supports revisioning, but I don't do any revisioning.
So. Interesting. I'm using Apple's backup application, which is really quite good. Using that?
Yeah, Alex? It actually sounds like they kind of have taken
merged
backup
them.
And merged it into a better interface. Really.
I do like backup. I mean, it's a great little app. It's making a whole bunch every day. First, it does that whole image of everything you want. I do it folder-based. And then its daily additions to it is another disk image, which just has the changes. So it's kind of cool in that you can, you know, you can open them up and mount them and burn them to CDs, whatever you want to do. It's pretty functional. The things I don't like is it really takes over your system. Like when backup's running, you shouldn't do anything else in your system because it's very slow. So every morning at 9, I get in and it starts at that time and I've got to go leave the office. And click
really?
The right button.
I haven't had that experience.
Or are you having it back up all your settings files?
I have it back up my entire home directory, like I think, once a week. And then once every other week, I have it back up my entire disk.
See, I'm doing daily all settings, and then daily like an art folder and daily a photo folder. And it doesn't. I think it's also making copies of some of the data before it transfers it over on files that are open to applications. Mm. So I'm not sure why it's so slow, but it's a little frustrating. I mean, it only takes, you know, 20 minutes, but during that time, I shouldn't use my machine. In any case, though, Time Machine does it a different way. And the interface that I saw, it seems so comfortable for people to use it that I'm concerned they're going to start using it as an archive and not just a backup. So I want to be clear about that idea that when you take a copy of something and you make a backup, the idea is that you're not really accessing that as a storage, or you're accessing that in case of failure, and you actually want to access the files in a different place. If you want to take older files you care about and you want to keep them for a long time and access them, but you don't want them on your primary machine, that's an archive of data, and you need a backup of archives. So that's clear to everybody?
Yeah, I think that's an important point, because a lot of people think, oh, they'll just make a copy of a file and put it on their desktop, and that's their backup. But if their hard drive dies, their computer dies, it's gone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Altogether, you copy everything that, you know, what they think is their backup. So that's just really an archive of the file or a copy of the file. Even if you're putting it into another system, what I do is I take photos and I'll export them off onto a DVD. Well, periodically, I'll actually clear out pictures off my local computer just to clear, you know, when they get to be 3-4 years old. And I clear that out. Well, now there's only one copy existing. That's that DVD backup.
And that's an archive.
That now becomes an archive. So I actually go and take those DVDs and duplicate it.
Yeah, and then you
always want two copies sitting somewhere. So if media dies or your hard drive dies, your computer dies, you have a copy somewhere.
And that's the thing is if you're not conscious of that idea and you're using something like Time Machine where it's very easy to get files, you can go, oh, you know, I got those files in Time Machine. For, you know, I just have to look back on in March and I'll see all those pictures of my niece's birthday party. So I can delete them off my computer and they're totally safe. But the problem is that's only on one hard drive, that whole backup solution. So you really don't use it as an archive. And it's a little bit, I mean, it's better having that it's built in, that there's a backing up solution that's really part of the OS that's, you know, pushed upon by Apple. Mm-hmm. But I'm concerned people use it as an archive and not a backup.
Yeah. I was playing with it a little bit. I didn't get much time to play with it entirely, but the underlying technology that I've read about is really, really neat, but it's not as configurable as I would like it.
You were saying it has hard links and virtual links. What do you mean by that? Or
it's,
someone else want to handle it?
It's something that it would take 5 minutes to explain. So yeah, if you're interested, go online and look it up. It's really, really neat. All of you going online. But yeah, it's a really neat thing that, as far as I know, hasn't been done before. And I've got multiple hard drives which I store different data on each one. Like, I do video editing, so I have a video editing hard drive where I store all of my media and stuff. And I'd really love to use a Time Machine type solution for all those other hard drives, but it's not configurable enough. It assumes that the only hard drive you need to back up is your main hard drive.
Right.
And it won't let you, I mean, it'll tell
so
you.
So it's those kind of configuration things that for most users, it's fine.
Yeah,
but for
exactly.
kind of tuning it, it's not exactly,
exactly.
the best choice.
Exactly. It's very, very transparent, but it also, if you go in and go to the system preferences, Time Machine preference pane, it'll actually show you what it's doing too.
All right.
You know? So it's really neat.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah.
The geeks this morning are Ben Jaffe, Ryder Brooks, Alex Leas, Miles Elam. My name's Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Geek Speak. We're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. We're looking for AC sources for plugging in laptops. Wait, here, I've got full battery. Just take my lead.
That won't work with me.
Oh, man, he's got an old computer.
Yeah, I've got an older one.
Bummer. All right, so GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, Notary Public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. KUSP co-sponsors UCSC's Arts and Lectures presentation of Ravi Shankar's Festival of India. Ravi Shankar will perform with daughter Anushka Shankar and an outstanding ensemble for an evening of Eastern classical music. The performance is Sunday, November 4th at 8 p.m. at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium. For tickets and more information, please call 459-2159 or visit online at santacruzcivic.com. Stay tuned with KUSP for Castle College this morning at 11 a.m. on the Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning, Miles Elam, Alex Leas, Ryder Brooks, and Ben Jaffe. We're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. Rick Filman is awaiting your call. To pipe it into the Air Room, the phone numbers are 476-2800. That's 476-2800. Or outside the 831 area code, you're welcome to call us toll-free. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. I think we're going to jump right into calls because we have someone waiting for us. And this is from Atlanta, Georgia. Larry, welcome to Geek Speak. Okay, no. Oh, sorry, didn't push it. Larry, hi.
Lyle.
Thanks.
Hello.
Hello, you're on air. Thanks for calling.
Oh, sorry. First, let me say, thank you so very much for taking my call. I need some help. What I have, my friend, is a couple of older computers, which I'm trying to resurrect. They're old but fine. And in addition, Lyle, I have a couple of older but still very usable, very good ID hard drives. You know, they kind of range from like 250 gigs to about 120 gigs.
Okay.
From 250 megs to about 120 gigs.
Okay.
My question to you, my friend, hopefully you know, is there any kind of guideline I can find which will tell me approximately how large a hard drive a particular BIOS will support?
How many hard drives?
How many and how large? Like 1 gig, 10 gigs, 120 gigs?
Uh-huh. What computers are you talking about here?
Oh gosh, what I have is a bunch of older cases.
Hmm.
You know,
you're looking to kind of make a farm of data storage based off of these drives.
Yeah,
I think that's going to get pretty complicated, a little hard to answer. Specifically, you want to know if this board, how many drives, what size drives can it handle?
I'd like to know exactly how large a hard drive the BIOS will support, and I just wonder. And if there's any kind of guideline or a website I can go to for more information on different BIOSes.
Alex? I'm sorry. I meant Miles. Got an idea on this? Miles seems to be thinking about it. So.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. And my quick answer to that is motherboards are cheap. if you get a recent one, it'll handle any hard drive you throw at it.
That's a good point.
Especially a parallel version.
I have some input. I think this is going to be... motherboard vendor implementation specific, how they've modified their BIOS. I mean, because you can have the same BIOS on multiple computers, but they've been tweaked by the manufacturers in different ways. So I think you're going to have to find out who the vendor of the motherboard is and go to their website and look it up. If it's really old, I mean, one of the things you're going to look for is LBA translation in the motherboard, which is one of the methods that they use to sort of trick the hardware into being seen as, you know, something that can map out to a larger drive than it would normally be able to. So you want to make sure the LBA translation is turned on in the BIOS. It really depends on how old you're talking. I mean, you're going to probably either run into an 8 gig limit or like 137 gigabyte limit.
And would you guys have a general timeline? Like in the last 4 years, you're not going to find a board that can't handle 120 gig?
It's about 5 years ago that the 137 gig barrier was
crossed.
Yeah,
right.
So,
and then about 10 years ago was when the 8 gig. No, actually, it's more than that.
It's probably like 12 or more years ago is when 8 gig was.
So those are the crossover points: 8 gig and then 137.
Right. Now you're also going to have issues with what operating system and the drivers
completely
as well. We're just talking hardware. So if you're trying to put like Windows 95 on here. Or something older, you know, you're going to have issues with drive capacity being recognized by the drivers by the OS.
Good advice. Good.
Thank you, Larry, so much for the call. Thank you so much for calling. We are taking calls with questions and comments technology. We're kind of talking about Apple's new operating system, but we're welcome to take any calls you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We're going to go ahead and go to Santa Cruz. Steve in Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Lyle, how you doing?
Quite well. What's your question today?
Well, Lyle, this has to do with transferring files between my Mac Mini and my Windows laptop, okay?
Okay.
Now, we've all seen over the years things get more compatible and more compatible, but when I go off on a business trip, I want to take all my records with me. So we're not talking about terabytes of data. It's only 2.5 gigs of data. So the simplest way to do it, of course, is to hook their network, the computer, so I just try to copy from from the one computer onto the other computer. Sure enough, I get this error message after it's gone through a bunch of files that it won't copy this file because the file name is too long or you've got some right. symbol.
Are you,
are you
copying from the Mac to the Windows? Or,
yes.
And are you on the Windows when you do it, or are you on the Mac when you do it?
I'm doing it from the Mac.
Okay. Try it from the Windows.
Well, okay. Well, that's another issue. That brings us to issue number two. When I go to my Windows machine and I go to network and I can see my Macintosh on uh-huh. it, but when I try to log into it, it won't accept it.
Okay, that's a little interesting.
Yeah.
Are you running the most recent OS 10?
Yes.
Well, not the most recent, but Tiger?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
The latest Tiger.
Okay. First off, the reason why I suggest connecting from Windows onto the Mac is that when you connect the other way, when you're on the Macintosh and you connect to a Windows machine or a Linux machine and you say copy,
yep.
the Finder will put a whole bunch of metadata files, these dot underscore files, and a dot DS file, which basically talks about how the files are presented in OS X. And all these files will show up on your Windows machine. Now, if you have your Windows machine by default hiding invisible file or not showing invisible files, it won't show up. But it's kind of a cluttering. The Windows machine doesn't need it. And in any case, so that's why I say grab it from Windows. The other part of it is that there are some file names that are legal in the Macintosh environment that are not legal in the Windows environment.
Well, I know. Okay. That's the problem I've run into.
That's the problem I've run into. Now, you can, of course, go and try to find out what those are in your library and change the file names inside iTunes.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of them in there because they've got dates. Like, you might have a file name with a date with slash marks in
right.
it. You know, there's hundreds of them.
Right. Now, but I think when you have sharing on the Mac on, and you say Windows sharing on the Mac, which you need to have in the system preferences of sharing, you have to have the Windows enabled check mark. Make sure you have that. When you do that, Macintosh should be changing the file names to be compatible with Windows.
That's been done.
Okay. So now you can't connect from the Windows machine to the Mac. What's the error that you're getting?
Well, it gives you – I see it, and it says connecting to – and it's got the name of my computer, and it wants my username and my password, which I put in the username.
And you're using the short name username?
Yes.
Okay.
And the password, which, you know, I need is my – and when I just say okay, it comes back and it does two things. It says log on unsuccessful. Windows is unable to log you on. Be sure that your username and password are connect. And then it takes – in the username box, it changed it from my username to the username of the laptop itself with a slash mark and then the username of the Macintosh, which is bizarre.
That's a domain – that's a Windows domain –
domain
idea.
Or work group, yeah.
Yeah. And the basic idea is that in Windows, you specify what work group or domain you're a part of when you give a password, and then that's the authentication it's used. It's mm-hmm. not actually needed on Windows.
The Mac may be assuming it, though. So one thing to check on your Windows machine is what domain or work group it belongs to. A lot of times when you're just installing it for home, it just shows up as home or
yeah.
work group.
To verify that it has the right work group.
Right.
Yeah, you might want to change your machine name to something very short. Like if it has any spaces or apostrophes or anything in the machine name,
no.
that's under sharing as well.
Yeah, I know. I do that too.
Okay, and then it should be okay to go ahead and when you put in the username from Windows to put the machine name slash the username and then the password. But you've probably tried that.
Well, like I said, it has the oh, I see what you're saying, put the other machine name.
Because what you're doing is if your Windows machine says, I am part of this work group and I normally by default authenticate off of that, the Mac knows nothing about that work group idea. So you need to tell the Windows machine to actually use the local user account on the Macintosh. And the way you specify that is by giving the username or the machine name and then a slash and then the username.
Okay.
So I'm assuming that you're not providing global shared access for
no.
what's on your Mac. You might want to do that temporarily if you have a secure network to get around the authentication.
Think that might work? Okay.
Might.
Now, when I've tried one last question, when I've said, "All right, to hell with this, it's not going to work," and I use I just put a flash memory card in the USB port and just
great
copy
idea.
It onto
sure.
there. After I copy it onto that, and then I can copy it onto the Vista, it'll dump the 2.5 or 3 gigs of data into the laptop in 10 or 15 minutes. But the amount of time that it takes to load on from the Macintosh is like hours and hours and hours.
Ah.
Why is that so slow?
You have an older Macintosh?
No. It's Mac Mini. You
is know, it the
that
same?
Mac Mini we've talked about before.
And this is a USB thumb drive?
Yes.
And you're plugging directly into the back of the Mac Mini, or are you plugging into your laptop?
No, I went, well, I guess.
I mean, sorry, the keyboard.
No, I go right directly to the back of the Mac Mini. And it
yeah,
just seems
that's
to
what I'm wondering.
Forever like. To load 2.5 gigs of data onto one of these flash drives.
Do you have a cinema display?
Do I have a, no.
The power output on the USB, on So what's going to happen in USB is it's going to try to detect the device's power drain and decide if it can power it effectively. And if it can't, it's going to switch down to USB 1. Even though the device is still working and still powered, it assumes that it's going to be USB 1, so it doesn't do that. And your Windows machine is going to assume USB 2. So you probably need a more power. So the reason why I asked if you had a cinema display, when I run into this issue, I use the cinema display USB port because it seems to be powered really well.
Okay, well, that gives me something else to look at.
So you could try to get a USB 2 hub. Right. And see if that worked. But Ben, you had some ideas for Steve?
One more quick question for you is, do you need to access your records from your Windows machine?
Because it's when I go on a trip, so I like to bring my records with me.
Oh, I see. Because I was going to suggest if you don't need to access them from your Windows machine, you can actually create an archive of it, and that'll take all of your illegal character names, and it'll just plop it into a zip file, and then you can transfer the zip file. But if you need to...
Then uncoding... Actually, no, it might work. If you just zip it on a Macintosh and unzip it on a Windows machine, you wouldn't have that file name problem. And
that's interesting. There's a creative approach.
Because the zip
that
would
hadn't
make
occurred
sure,
to me.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have the DS store and the dot underscore yada, 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 because the Mac would be creating the archive without that stuff in it, I think.
And the Windows Explorer will actually open up a zip file like it's in, you know, at least last I checked on XP and stuff, it'll open it up the zip file like you're in an Explorer window, so you can browse the files really quickly like that, too.
Great. Well, you guys have given me three different approaches, so
Steve,
appreciate
good
it.
Luck.
Thanks. Okay, great talking to you again,
and
Lyle.
Thanks for talking to Steve.
Bye. Talking about DS Store, there is a hack out there that you can turn off creation of DS Store information on the PCs over the network.
There's a hack on it?
Uh-huh.
Okay, I'd love to get the URL for that. That'd be great. In fact, if you give it to me, I'll put it online.
Mm-hmm.
From Pacific Grove, Diane, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Yes,
hi. I have a comment, and then I have a question, and they're not related.
And you just made a statement, so go ahead. Let's start with you.
The comment was about IMAP from Google that you were talking about earlier. I heard on NPR yesterday that they used it down in San Diego to map all the fires, and it was a real good source of information for people online. The local public radio station did that, and they were just...
That's true. Google mapping, Alex actually lives in Southern California, who's here, and he made some great use of the Google Maps to
flag it. Yeah, they were going on and on about it, about how wonderful it was for people to get information.
Yeah, it was really great. He took photographs and marked where those photographs were. And Alex, can we put that URL up on the site? I think it'd be really wonderful.
We'll put it up.
The one little thing, the correction a little bit, is that we're using a term called IMAP, and though it sounds like mapping technology, it's actually email technology. It's called, what does the IMAP stand for?
Uh-huh.
Alex Miles is really good with this.
Don't remember.
IMAP stands for
Internet Miles on an acronym.
Internet Mail Access Protocol.
Yeah.
Yeah, we win. So, but in any case, you're right. Mapping technology in Google Earth is wonderful. What's your question?
I have a question. I learned am learning the hard way about backup with Apple Backup on my iDisk.
It seems like in backup, everyone learns the hard way. The first time.
Well, I lost a whole bunch of stuff the other day. And I guess my real... I don't have a question about my stuff. It's just... It does it in increments. The backup is in increments. And I was wondering... I got in trouble because I thought, well, how many increments can you have here? From here to eternity? And then I thought, well, maybe I better take some of the increments off because it's probably going to, use up all my iDisk and space. And so my question is, I guess, do you just have to back up forever and ever and ever and ever and ever incrementally like that?
Actually, no. In the menus, I don't remember exactly where in the menus, you can specify to do a full backup.
That's what I will do.
So what I do is I usually do a full backup. I do increments for a while. Then I redo a new full backup, and I get and I get rid of my old increments.
That's what I need to do.
Yeah, and that's one
way
to
help. That's the lesson I've learned.
What you do lose, though, is that when you keep the increments, you can actually go back to a point in time to.
Yeah, I understand that, and I tried that, but the bad part of it was I had in my Eudora settings file was corrupted somehow.
And that's what increments are great for. So what I would really recommend, especially if it's just a settings that you're saving in not a lot of data, but you're dealing with settings, and I do these in two different – I do one settings and one data backup because the settings stuff when it changes and corruptions like that is really kind of a pain. But it's very small, so you can kind of save that stuff forever. So I do a full backup. You make a copy of that full backup onto a DVD or something, and then you do incremental, and then you do a new full backup, and you can erase all the old stuff. But you have that old backup copy as well.
Right.
So that's a great way to do it. Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Thanks
for your call. That was Diane from Pacific Grove. We are taking questions and comments on GeekSpeak today. I'll give you the phone numbers in just a second to join us. In the air room, Ben Jaffe, Ryder Brooks, Alex Leas, and Miles Elam. Yeah, Alex, the fires were kind of dangerous from where you were.
They were about 3/4 of a mile from my house. So yeah, I was a little worried at that point in time.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you see the – I was looking at Google Earth from your link, which had all these red little tags and like where the firefighters were meeting and stuff. But one of the things in the satellite picture is that between you and the fire is this giant quarry. I'm like, well, you're safe. You're like insulated.
Well, a lot of that giant quarry, though, is full of brush, so it kind of it's actually a fuel line to my home.
So in the Google Earth like pictures, that's 10 years old when the quarry didn't have brush.
Well, the quarry was more on the left. The fuel is kind of leading around it to the right, so it kind of came right up. So they actually
we
put
can
a
laugh
line
about it now, of course, because you're okay, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I would love to get that. You're all online. I can do that as well.
I'll give you that.
On geekspeak.org. We're taking calls and questions of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP. And we're going to take a call from Big Sur. Jim, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yes, good morning, guys. I picked up a new iMac with a 24-inch screen, and I have some questions for you. If I want to expand the 1 gigabyte RAM that came with the machine, can I do that, and how far can I go with that?
Is this the 24-inch iMac?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's
up to 4 gigs.
Yeah, 4 gigs, I think, is the max, and there's a really easy port on the bottom to get to the memory, so you don't have to, like, crack the whole thing open. The memory can be upgraded pretty easily.
Okay, so I can go up to 4 gigs.
Yeah, and what you want to do, and I would recommend not buying the memory sticks from Apple, because they have a pretty big surcharge. Let me see if I can, I'll try to, in a few minutes, when someone else is talking for a while, I'll try to get you, I'll put you out a URL for really good access to memory. One of the things they do is that you put in your model number and everything, and you say what you have, and then you can buy a kit of more memory that will be the max for your computer. It's a pretty nice source.
Is that from Apple, or?
No, it's from a different site, and the company that I've been using. Okay, memory upgrades, there it is. The website that I like is datamemorysystems.com. Datamemorysystems.com.
Okay.
All right?
Great. Excellent.
And we'll put that online, of course, too, for all you podcast listeners.
Okay.
Thank you. Do you have one more question for us?
I do. If I want to expand the hard drive from 320, how far can I go?
That's harder.
Yeah. You might actually void your warranty trying to expand the hard drive on your own.
Really?
Yeah, because the iMac is really built for elegance and simplicity, and that doesn't lead very well to upgradability.
Okay, so I'll just make liberal use of backup drives.
Yeah, or just attach an external drive.
Jim,
what are you thinking? Just getting an external USB or FireWire drive and just plugging it in.
And accessing that. Jim, what do you do that uses so much storage space?
It's photography. I talked to you guys last week about on another question. So I have lots and lots of images.
You know, I would really highly recommend you getting a SAN device, like a personal SAN device. It's a local area network type device.
NAS,
excuse me. And the reason being that you want your data to be safe, and the best way to do that is to get it on multiple drives. And if you set up a NAS, I like the InFront box, which is now owned by Netgear, called ReadyNAS. It's got a good name. You fill that with like 5 hard drives. You get 2 terabytes, depending on how much money you spend on the hard drives, of storage. It's backed up. It tells you when something fails. And it's a very wonderful feeling for me when I get my files on that machine, because I know that it's safe.
Okay. I have 2 Western Digital external drives.
Yeah.
But they don't seem to be very automatic.
Yeah.
So ReadyNAS is the channeling process and the drives, right?
Well, I think they do have software for it. You still have to deal with the software of getting the drives over.
Okay.
The way I do it is kind of a manual process. After taking some photographs, I import them and make sure they're in separate folders, and I copy those full folders over. So,
okay.
But I'm also using Apple's backup program that also makes an image. So I've kind of got 2 copies on that same drive. One is for archive and one is for backup, and then I have another machine for backup. In any case,
most NAS implementations have multiple ways for you to transfer your data. I mean, the ReadyNAS I think has the Retrospect software. I don't know if that works on the Mac. Does that work on the Mac? Well,
the Retrospect software.
Yeah,
yeah, I use Retrospect to work.
Sure. I think that's what it comes with software wise.
Oh yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, which is pretty good.
Quick question on: do I still need some kind of security like Norton or McAfee when I have a Mac?
That's a good question.
That's an ongoing debate, actually.
And I'm using Fusion to run my Windows programs on the Mac.
Fusion? Oh, Ben, you know about Fusion?
I don't.
Okay.
I do.
So you do, Ryder.
Yeah,
Someone said it recently.
The VMware Fusion?
Oh, it's a VMware. Okay.
Is that what you're talking about? That Fusion?
It's
virtual machine?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that works pretty well. I mean, it depends on what you want to do with it. I mean, it's...
But because I'm running Windows programs, does that increase the likelihood I should have keep Norton Security?
You should have virus security in your Windows installation on your Macintosh. Mm-hmm. But the Macintosh... Now, this goes back and forth. I don't have virus protection on my Macintosh.
Uh-huh.
We haven't seen anything in the wild that affects Macintosh.
Okay.
No one's written the virus. But it seems like... I should say, Alex, you're the security expert.
Yeah, I mean, that's not entirely... There have been some things on Macs. So usually they're application exploits that are cross-platform, like Excel, Meta, exploits, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I would kind of go along the line of what you're saying, Lyle, is to have your antivirus in your Windows installation. I wouldn't worry about the viruses that get into your Windows system that can end up attacking your Mac. I don't think I've ever seen a cross-platform exploit of that nature.
Yeah, but if you have a virtual machine, I don't know if I'm not familiar with this one that we're talking about, but if you have a virtual machine of Windows running and it mounts your hard drive of your OS X operating system,
yeah,
then it's easy for the virus to be, going
through.
It can
go and do damage.
Yeah, possibly.
And that'd be a concern. It could find, if it's looking for private information, it could also do that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I do have a comment about that. If you, with Parallels and VMware Fusion on the Mac, there is a way for you to sort of integrate your networking between your two file systems, between your Mac and your PC via SMB. That does kind of open you up to potentially infecting your Mac files with viruses.
But the thing is,
if you open it up for that,
Macintosh having a virus scanner isn't necessary. I mean, if you scan it, you might find it, but the damage might have already been done.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, that reinforces your need to put it on the Windows installation. But there is a way that if you didn't do that, you could contaminate some of your Mac files.
Okay, good. That's a good answer. Now, one last quick question. Comparing the operating system that came on my new machine with Leopard, which I can upgrade to for $10, what do you guys think of Leopard?
Well, we've been talking about it a bit in the early part of the...
I'm sorry, I got a call.
It's okay, Jim. I think that you should wait a little while. Make sure you read your information about it.
Yeah.
And just wait. This is my recommendation. Wait for the first patch, or at least wait for a week or so, because you're going to start hearing errors and stuff. Now, Ben got a compatibility list for what's failing on Leopard right now. Okay. And so you might want to go to the GeekSpeak site. Ben's going to give you that URL, and I'll put it online to kind of learn about what applications aren't working on Leopard yet. And if you don't have any in that list, then maybe it's not a big deal, and you could go ahead and go with Leopard. But if you know you have one on there that you want to use, then you'd want to wait. But make sure you read the information on how long you can wait until Apple says you got to give more than $10.
Okay.
Thank you so much for the call. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
So Ben, what's the URL and such?
It's on macrumors.com. If you go to guides.macrumors.com, it's one of the links on that page. It's under newest pages. It's a list of applications that are not compatible with Leopard. Or you can also probably just do a Google search of that. Leopard.
We'll put it online.
Yeah.
I need to get the URL from you.
Good point, we'll put it
on geekspeak.org. It would be fine. And I noticed that are you not on our chat still, I think? Is that true? We're using a chat, and I sent you an email. But since you're using Leopard, you probably haven't checked your email yet. So in any case, Sean Cleveland, are you joining us?
Yeah.
Oh, hi, Sean. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah.
So you got news you want to cover?
No.
No? Okay. Just here for backup. All right.
Just Google IMAP is cool, but you talked about that.
Yeah, we did a little bit. Are you using it with Thunderbird?
I am using it with Thunderbird 2.0. You know, it's interesting. I had two email accounts, and one was enabled, one was not. And on a lark, I enabled POP on the one that I did not have IMAP support for yet. It hadn't enabled IMAP.
Oh, you have two Gmail accounts.
And now I have it. So I think what happened when I enabled POP on that email account, it moved me up, maybe.
Interesting. Okay.
I've enabled POP on my Gmail account.
Yeah, but did you check your mail through POP?
Yes, I do all the time with my iPhone.
I did the same thing. I've had it enabled for a while. And for some reason, when I went into config, it was all unset. I don't know what happened because I had it set. I had it working, and then I realized I had a whole bunch of mail that I wasn't getting on my client because somewhere, somehow, it got unset.
Yeah.
Now
mine
didn't
come
up
until Thursday. So.
OK. Okay, everybody check their Gmail settings and see if they've got it yet. Forwarding and pop. IMAP,
but
yes,
you know,
I've got it.
Yes. If you've got multiple Gmail accounts, yeah, it's really nice being able to use a third-party email app like Thunderbird to access them. And you can sort easier, search. I'm sure you talked about all this earlier.
We didn't really talk about the features of IMAP, but we did confuse everybody with the idea that it's Google mapping.
Yeah, with POP in Gmail, it was really frustrating because if you used multiple computers, you would check your email on one computer, and then when you went to your other computer, you would not see the email that you saw on the other computer. Because Gmail said, oh, you've already downloaded this, and there was no way to change that because you're not in charge of the server. They're doing right. that. And then when you set up POP through Gmail, you only get your mail starting at that point. You don't have access to all your old email.
And IMAP, it's different?
In IMAP, you get all of your old email, and you see all of the email on multiple clients. And you can have multiple clients connected to Gmail, which you couldn't with POP. So it works really well.
And one of the other nice things, though, about using IMAP over POP is if your computer dies, you don't have to worry about losing all your email because with POP, your email gets copied to your system typically. Now, granted, Google will keep copies. You don't have to delete from the server, but oftentimes that is a typical POP setup, whereas IMAP, the email always stays on the server. So if you go from one computer, you buy a new computer, your email's right there, your folders are there, everything's nicely organized for you right there.
And then you just have to worry about the fact that your email is on someone else's server.
Well, that's assuming you're running it on someone else's server.
Right, which is... Yeah. But then again, if you have web-based email, that's... You're already subject to that, so that's not going to be a change.
Yep.
All right, we have another call from just down the street. We're on 7th and 8th Avenues in Santa Cruz. That's where KSB Studios. And Dan is calling from 8th Avenue. So, Dan, neighbor, what's your question today?
Oh, hi there. Two brief questions. One, I would like to be able to send photographs through as an email attachment using Yahoo to a friend overseas.
Okay,
and
so you're
only able to upload one photograph at a time, and I'd like to find a way to compress the photographs into a file and send the entire file at one time.
And are you on a Windows machine or a Macintosh?
Windows.
Windows machine. So what you need is an application that makes zip files, but I'd be really
cautious.
That's
Windows.
I tried WinZip. Didn't work.
Wait, Windows can make zip files by default?
I think XP, right-click instead of doing new file folder.
It opens the files into Word documents. And all you get is machine language.
And who is that? The person that's receiving it, or you, is having this problem?
I sent it to another fictitious email account of mine, and I opened the file, and it opened. When I opened one of the photographs,
unfortunately,
it opened all of the photographs into Word, and all you could see was this.
Okay, why don't you do this? Why don't you go ahead and send us an email? Just go to geekspeak.org and fill out our contact form, and we'll get that email and try to help you out off air. We're kind of running out of time, and it's a little bit of a long answer. So, and go ahead and ask us both our questions through email. That'd be great.
Somebody gave me a computer with a Pentium 4 with an old Rambus.
I'm running out of room. I can't take your question.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, just send us an email. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You know, maybe after the show we should just walk over to Dan's house. He's only a block away. We could help him out. The geeks this morning were Miles Elam, Alex Lias. Alex, thanks for coming up from down south.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Ryder Brooks. Sean Cleveland joined us in the last minute. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah, thank you.
And Ben Jaffe, newest member to come in and speak with us. Thank you all for making GeekSpeak happen. And Rick Philman, thanks for answering the calls. To those that listen to the whole show, I'm sorry. And thank you so much for being here with us. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Broadcasting in HD radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Ardo, or on the web at kusp.org. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.